This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Under the RICO Act, murder became one of the predicate acts, one of the acts. So you're now able to go after guys for murder. So what happened was...
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the grand, stunting is destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on a fascinating guest. He is a former mobster. He is an author. He is a public speaker and an inspirational figure. And this is the one and only Michael Francis. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Zuby. Thanks for having me.
No doubt, man. Great to meet you in person.
Good to be here.
So, Michael, I've done a brief intro there. I'm sure that many of the listeners will be familiar with you and some of your story, but please introduce yourself.
Well, like you said, and I always say, former capo regime or captain with the Colombo crime family, one of the five New York Cosa Nostra families. My dad was the underboss of that family, and I was part of that life. I kind of followed in his footsteps. Originally, that wasn't my intent, but my dad drew a 50-year prison sentence back in 1967. I was a pre-med student in Hofstra University in 1970 when my dad went to begin serving that time. And my life changed dramatically at that point. My dad felt it was better for me to be as part of that life to help him get out of prison in a case that was really a bad case. My dad was framed in that case. So I was motivated to do that through a series of events. I became a made member myself, which is a term they use when you officially joined that life in 1975. And so all told, I was about 20 years in that life. And, I kind of made a name for myself, not always good in that life, because I became a major target. Law enforcement actually had 17 or 18 arrests. I was indicted 7 times at 2 federal racketeering cases, one brought on by Rudy Giuliani. Ended up going to trial 5 times and was either acquitted or dismissed in every case, so I was never convicted. But then I met a young girl who's now my wife for 38 years, a young Christian woman that kind of had a tremendous impact on me, changed the thought process and direction of my life. And as a result of that, I ended up taking a plea. I had a 10-year prison sentence on a major racketeering case, another one that they indicted me on. I had a $15 million restitution, $5 million in forfeitures. I married Camille in July of 85 and went off to prison in December of 85. Ended up doing 8 years in prison total. Walked away from that life amidst many challenges to try to get away from it. But and through a series of events that I believe were God-ordained, I became a public speaker, sharing my testimony. I'm now a believer in Jesus Christ. And been doing that over the past 25 years, between speaking, writing books, and doing whatever I can as part of ministry. And then I still have that entrepreneurial spirit, so I'm in the wine business, pizza business. All I can say is I've been extremely blessed, to be alive and free and speaking to you right now.
Awesome. That's an incredible summary right there. So there's so much that we can go into. Tell me a little bit about your childhood. Tell me about the story. Tell me about your family.
Very turbulent, Zuby, because my dad was major target of law enforcement, always under investigation, always being arrested. We law enforcement tactics very different that back then than they are today. My dad was under constant surveillance by a number of law enforcement agencies. So they were around us all the time. And I grew up in an atmosphere of hating the police and hating law enforcement because I love my dad. He was my hero. And we had a lot of trouble in the family. I had brothers and sisters younger than me. And my dad was, again, he was away. He was home. He was going on trial. He was home. And, you know, my mother had a lot of emotional stress during that time. So it was very turbulent. In a way, it caused my younger brother and sister, I believe, you know, as a result of my dad's involvement in that life, my sister became a drug addict. She was hooked on drugs, eventually died an overdose of drugs at the age of 27. My younger brother, drug addict for over 25 years. My younger sister, 41 years old, died young, emotional stress. So, and I attribute that all to the childhood that we grew up in. And then my dad goes to prison and actually does 40 years on that 50. He was in and out a few times on parole, but kept going back. So it wasn't a normal childhood in any way. As far as myself, you know, I went to school, I went to high school, got into college, had to deal with all of this, but somehow I was able to navigate through that. And fortunately, it didn't have the impact on me, I believe, that it had on the rest of my family. So I don't know why. I don't know, but just very blessed in that regard. But it was rough. It was tough.
Now more than ever, the ability to see through the chaos of traditional news media is an absolute necessity. Biased narratives and selective reporting obstruct the informed critical thinking that we should all be striving for. That's why I'm excited to introduce you to today's sponsor, Ground News. Ground News compiles stories from all across the political spectrum, globally and locally, giving you every angle so you get the full picture you need to stay ahead of rampant media bias. Every story comes with a quick visual breakdown of the number of articles covering it and the political bias, ownership, and headlines of the sources reporting. One of my favorite features is their blind spot feed, where you can see stories that are disproportionately covered by one side of the political spectrum or the other. Ground News does a great job at helping me see behind the curtain of mainstream media. I highly recommend you give Ground News a try. My listeners can get 40% off their Vantage subscription, which gives you unlimited access to all of their incredible features. Go to ground.news/Zuby or click the link in the description to subscribe for just $5 a month. Check out Ground News today and stay informed.
How did your father get involved in LA?
You know, my grandfather, who came over here from Italy, was a very well-respected guy in the neighborhood in Brooklyn. He knew a lot of guys, and so my father grew up around them. And my dad just saw this life as being attractive, and those guys in the life thought he had what it took to become a member of that life, so he went in that direction. My grandfather actually didn't want that for him, but my dad was, you know, he made up his own mind. But my dad did get involved and then became a very prominent figure in that life.
It's interesting because this is one of those, there's the movies, there's the books, there's the TV shows everyone hears about, you know, the mafia, these crime families and so on. It's sort of like a myth and a legend. It's one of those things that you know is real, but it's so far removed from most people's lives and experiences that it almost sounds like fiction, even though that you know it's fact. When you were a kid, how aware were you of what your dad was involved in and what was going on there?
You know, Zuby, the funny thing, my dad, when we had all of this law enforcement around us all the time, he would never bring what was going on in the outside world, in his world, into the house. He wouldn't even talk about it. In the house, we were a family. He didn't want to talk about it, even though it was all around us. So everything I knew about that life, I knew from what I witnessed, I knew from the media, I knew from other people telling me, never from my dad's lips. But it was so obvious, you know. I mean, I give you a story. I mean, I'm 10 years old. I'm playing ball in the street, and we lived on kind of an incline. So Frank throws a ball, goes over my head, rolls down it to where two agents were sitting in the car. It was surveilling my dad. And so one agent gets out of the car. He's a big guy, and he stops the ball with his foot, and I walk up to him. I said, sir, can I have my ball back? And he had a suit jacket on. He pulls his jacket aside. He's got a gun. He pulls it out. He said, this is for your old man one day. So, you know, 10 years old, that's kind of, wow, yeah, kind of scary. So, I mean, I couldn't help but know what was going on. You know, and, but again, never from my dad. Yeah, we'd never talk about it. And it was funny, you know, when he was outside of people, media was there, whatever, he would walk past them like they didn't even exist. You know, get in the car and never even talk about it. It was amazing. But obviously, like I said, It was all around.
Were you, what was that like as a child? I mean, going to school, going to college, all that. How aware were other people of who you were, who your father was? Were there children of other people who were in the mob in your school? I'm just trying to understand what those dynamics were.
Yeah, very aware. I mean, there were some kids, I had my issues with it. Some kids in the schoolyard, hey, you got off your dad. You know, whatever would come out in the papers, and I'd fight, you know, and then there was other kids that were kind of attracted to, you know, they were turned on by it. And then there were parents that maybe didn't want their kids hanging around with us, and then there were other families that they were, you know, they wanted to be around. And so, yeah, a little bit of both, you know. But it didn't affect me in a bad way, because I love my dad, and I found out during that time, you know, that love of my father just, that ruled everything for me at that point. So I dealt with it, you know. He was supportive of me, and I was supportive of him.
Yeah. What was he like as a father?
Again, very supportive. He didn't want this life for me. He wanted me to go to school, son, you know, be a professional, be the first professional in the family. He wanted me to be a doctor. He really wanted that. I was an athlete in school. He would never miss a game. I mean, he would be very supportive in that regard. My mom was the disciplinarian more than my dad. She was very, very strict with me. And my dad was, you know, kind of the balance of the life. So, you know, and as a result of that, you know, I loved him even more. So he was a great father. And he loved his kids, no doubt.
Yeah. And what happened? Tell me the story of him getting arrested and ending up in prison.
Well, you know, he was arrested and indicted on three state cases in New York, twice for grand larceny and once for murder, very serious and highly publicized. And he went to trial all three times over the period of a couple of years, you know, in and out of jail. But he was acquitted in all three of those cases.
Okay.
And in 66, he's indicted by a federal masterminding a nationwide string of bank robberies. Goes to trial, gets convicted. And he was out, he was sentenced to 50 years of prison, but he was out on bond until the appellate court either upheld or denied his appeal. It was denied. In 1970, he goes into prison to serve that time. And, you know, he was 50 years old when he went in. So actually 50 on top of that, it's a death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, during that time, I sat with my dad and I said, Dad, bank robbery. And he looked at me, Zuby, and he said, son, I'm innocent. I'm no bank robber. He said, I was framed in this case. My dad hadn't lied to me up to that point, and I believed him. And until this day, I'll take it to my grave. On that particular case, my dad was framed. He was no bank robber. You know what? People know it. And the reporters have known it. Even ex-FBI agents have told me I was a bad case.
Mm-hmm.
You won't go all the way, but they'll say it's a bad case. So that motivated me to want to help him. And then I had younger brothers and sisters. My mom, you know, she needed support. So I lost interest in school, you know, mainly too because Joe Colombo, who was the boss of our family, very close with us, he kind of took me under his wing. So I was around a lot more of my dad's friends, you know, and guys involved in that life, and they influenced me.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, if you don't help your dad, he's going to die in prison. So I lose interest in school, and that's when I started to say, Dad, how am I going to help you, you know? And at one point in time in a meeting in prison in the visiting room in Leavenworth Penitentiary, he proposed me for membership while I was 20 years old.
So when you said that you got involved in that to help him, in what respect?
Well, we needed to get to the witnesses that testified against him because my dad said they were all perjuring themselves. They lied on the stand. We needed money for attorneys because, you know, there's a real myth in that life. You go to prison that, you know, the family is throwing money at you and taking care of the family and paying your attorneys. So that's not true at all. My dad had some business on the street and he was collecting money on a monthly basis for that. But when that ran out, 2 or 3 years, it ran out. That was it. So I became, you know, pretty much a sole provider for my family. So between getting lawyers, working on the appeals, hiring an investigator to go after and try to uncover the truth with the witnesses, it was a full-time job.
So tell me about that process. How old were you at the time when you used
it? I was 20, and when my dad proposed me, 2021, be clear on that. And it was about a three-year process. I was a recruit where I had to prove myself worthy to become a member of that life. And what that means is, you know, Zubin, when you take that oath, prior to taking the oath, they tell you, The family comes first before anything. If your mother is sick and dying, you're at her bedside, we call you to service, you leave your mother, you come and serve us. We're number one in your life before anything and everything. When and if you feel this, you deserve, we deserve, or you deserve rather, this privilege, this honor to become a member, we'll let you know. So at that point, you're on call 24 hours a day. You have to do whatever that you're told to do. Now, discipline, authority, very important. Like, you had a meeting at 8 o'clock, you're not there at 7:30, you're late. You could never be late. It doesn't matter what the issue is. If there's traffic, sleep over the night before. You know, you can never make excuses. And then, you know, to be perfectly honest, and, you know, people know who I am, that life can be violent at times. If you're part of the life, you're part of the violence. If you're told to do something, you have to do it. And for me, it was a 2.5-year process before I proved myself worthy, and they administered the oath to me, and I became a MATE member.
Was there some trepidation there, or was it something you were excited about and looking forward to?
You know, for me, it was exciting for me because I wanted to be something that my dad was part of. You know, that's what my dad meant to me at that point. He was my hero. And I didn't want to disappoint him, so I tried to be the best possible guy I could be in that life. The night that I got made, which happened to be Halloween night, just by coincidence, 1975 was a secure night. It was exhilarating. You know, I took the life very seriously back then. I took the oath very seriously. So it was exhilarating to finally make it and become a member on that night. I have to be honest.
Okay. And what changed for you then from that moment?
Well, you know, now you're a MATE guy, and you have status. You know, now it's up to you to use the life as best as you can. Number one, to help my dad, and number two, to make money, because that's what we needed. We needed money. So I was fortunate. I knew how to use that life to benefit me in business. I was pretty entrepreneurial for some reason. It started to come out in me, and I had a lot of success as a result. Same time, I became a major target of law enforcement because from my dad, it went right to me. You know, arrested 18 times, indicted 7 times, 2 federal racketeering cases, trial 5 times, and then ended up in prison, like I said. So I had, while I was striving to help my dad be the best possible guy I could be and make my status in that life, I'm also fighting the government constantly. So it was a tough grind.
Yeah. And so you were from what I understand, you're the oldest of all the siblings?
I actually had, my dad was married once before, and I had an older brother who had nothing to do with the life. He didn't want any part of it. And younger sister and then older sister.
Okay. So you get involved 2021, and how many people were you, what level do you come in at? I'm trying to understand this.
Yeah, you start out as a soldier. That's the entry. And when my dad did get out on parole, he was out 5 times and kept going back for a total of 40 years. But when my dad came out and was on parole, he couldn't really associate with anybody off parole. My dad was a copper general captain, so he made me his acting captain. So that's an official position. So I was acting on behalf of my father. Then in 1980, I was made an official captain myself. So in the ranking, you have the soldiers on the bottom. We actually have an associate, but an associate never took the oath. You have associates. A soldier that's an official position, then you have a coupler regime, which is very powerful because you have men underneath you that were assigned to you by the boss. Boss is at the top, and you have an underboss and a consigliere, which is kind of the family advisor. So a coupler regime is a very powerful position. Most people that become boss are the coupler regime, and then they go to boss.
So what sort of activities were you involved in?
Well, you know, I had some of the basic things that you do on the street. I had a number of bookmakers, you know, guys taking bets illegally that were under me. They answered to me. I had a huge shylocking business. I was lending out money on them at usurious rates because I had money. And basically, it was those two things, street level, that I was doing. I also had a lot of legitimate business. I had a Mazda agency, a car agency. I had a Chevrolet agency and had eventually a film production company. I had a couple of restaurants that I was involved in. So I was pretty entrepreneurial in that regard. But the biggest illegal activity I got involved in, I stayed away from drugs, didn't want anything to do with drugs. was the wholesale gasoline business. And to make a very long story short, devised a scheme with the help of another to defraud the government out of tax on every gallon of gasoline. And I was selling it on the retail level through gas stations and then became a wholesaler and was selling it on a wholesale level. To give you an idea of business, I ran that operation for almost 8 years. At the height of our operation, we were selling 500 million gallons of gas a month, taking down 20, 30, 40 cents a gallon, whatever the market would bear. So we were bringing in several million dollars a week.
Example. How do you do that for 8 years without them being aware of it? I mean, it doesn't seem possible to me. Obviously, it was, but I'm wondering how something like that can.
Well, I'm going to answer something very appropriate for something that happened yesterday. I don't know if you saw the news, but the New York City Housing Authority, that's been around since 1935. Yesterday, the biggest bust in history is from the Justice Department. They arrested 70 people from the New York City Housing Department that were on the take. They were getting bribed. 70. Now, why that's so fantastic is because that's about a third of the agency. That many people, but it was going on for over 10 years. So how does that go undetected when 70 people are on the take taking bribes from contractors? So to answer your question, we were always one step ahead of the gun. They couldn't figure out what we were
doing. Yeah.
I had accountants on the payroll. My partner was just about at the genius level and knowing how to detect things in advance. And I was able to keep everything under control. So we ran it, and they just didn't know what we were doing. And the only way they found out was when my partner got himself in trouble on an unrelated matter. He became an informant. Had to help himself out. He gave up the whole operation.
Gotcha. And how many families were operating at this time?
In New York, 5. Yeah. Throughout the country, 9. Okay. In New York, 5. And New York is a stronghold for causing our struggle.
What's it like from then till now? Because I know that, of course, some of these families at least certainly still exist and operate. It seems like there was this peak of it decades ago, I think, probably prior to when I was born, where lots of the movies and the stories, they were all... I'm
37. I was born in 1986.
Okay. So a lot of the story you're telling me, I'm just thinking, man, like this all happened before I existed.
Well, made some of it. I would say so, because the golden years of Cosa Nostra in this country were from the late 40s, early 50s, right through the mid-80s. So here's Mr. And the reason for that... is during that period of time, we had tremendous control and influence in the country. We controlled just about every major union, from the labor unions right through the Teamsters and everything else. Julie, if you control the unions in this country, you control the country in large part. Because why? What do politicians want? They want votes and they want money. Mm-hmm. You have the Teamsters union, you got 2.5 million members. That's a lot of votes. We have pension funds in the billions of dollars. We have a lot of money, so we can support campaigns. And that's just one union. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of political clout right into the White House. We had a lot of control of corporate America because we controlled the unions, and the unions were a lot more powerful back then than they are today. We controlled them. So we had a lot of power. But then what happens? Racketeering Act, the RICO Act, mm-hmm. comes into effect in the early 80s, mid-80s, and it was devastating. It changed the face of Cosa Nostra in this country. Why? Very difficult statute to defend. I know I had 3 of them. Number one. Number two, the amount of time they were given. One count can give you 20 years in prison with no more parole. They abolished parole. So if you had a 20-year sentence, you had to do 85%. You do all like 17 years. You know, no good time, nothing. That's it. So... as a result of that, it also, what it did is, prior to the RICO statute, murder could not be indicted by the feds. It was a state crime. So the feds had no jurisdiction over murder unless you murdered a federal person or on federal ground. That didn't happen. Under the RICO Act, murder became one of the predicate acts, one of the acts. So you're now able to go after guys for murder. So what happened was, so many guys turned informant, and the law was so hard to defend, everybody had RICO indictments, and they were convicting people left and right. It was devastating, and so many guys were becoming informants, and that changed the life. They also have a tremendous forfeiture statute. How serious is it? You buy a house that costs $2 million, and they prove that $1 of illegal money went into that house, they confiscate the whole property. Mm-hmm. So between the forfeiture statute and the criminal penalties, it was devastating. That changed the life. It's not near as powerful as it was back then. There are still five families. It's not going to go away in my lifetime, but it's changed dramatically. We don't have the clout that they once did.
Mm-hmm. What exactly is the RICO Act? It's one of those things that I've heard a lot about. I think I have some familiarity with it, but I'm aware it's going to be a global audience that's listening to this, to a lot of people outside the U.S. in particular. RICO isn't going to mean anything to them. So what specifically does that mean?
Well, basically, it's Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organizations Act. That's what it says. That's RICO stands for. And basically, number one, they have to prove that you're part of a criminal enterprise, which is not difficult. The burden of proof on that is very low. And then they have to prove that you've committed crimes in a pattern, okay, two or more in a pattern of racketeering as being part of that criminal enterprise.
Okay.
And as long as they establish that, then you have a legitimate, in their view, RICO Act violation. But it's very, very hard to defend because it's a complicated law. And a lot of the lawyers that were first hit with this didn't even understand. But the statute is so broad and it's so easy, you know, to get a conviction on. And I don't know too many people, I beat a big racketeer case brought on by Rudy Giuliani, but some of my co-defendants were convicted. We did all get away with it. But so I don't know many people that have ever walked away from a racketeering indictment. That's how difficult it is. I can't get into all the details of the statute. It's very complicated. But and, you know, the government, initially it was used to go against organized crime, but now they're using it in civil matters, too. I mean, they use it on Wall Street. They, you know, if you give the government an inch, they're going to take a yard, and they're going to take it as far as they can possibly take it. So it's been a devastating law. A lot of people, a lot of lawyers say it's unconstitutional because under the RICO statute, one of the predicate acts, you need two predicate acts. One predicate act could be a case that you were indicted for, went to trial for, and were acquitted of. And they can use that as a predicate act. So even if you were found innocent, okay, although you were accused of that, they can use that as a predicate act. And people say, well, that's unconstitutional. It's double jeopardy. It's whatever. Mm. But under the RICO statute, it's not.
I've heard you say before that you knew while you were getting involved in this stuff that you had a limited amount of time as a free man. So What was that feeling or emotion like, knowing you have this sort of Damocles, this black cloud hanging over your head, and you don't know the timing, you don't know the situation, but you know, okay, at some point, this run is going to have to cease?
You know, Zuby, I don't want to come off the wrong way here and sound, you know, like I'm somebody special or macho or anything like that. For some reason, I just was able to deal with it. I said, you know what? One of these days, I'm probably going to go to prison, but I'm going to fight like heck to stay out. And it was so much ingrained in me from the time I was a kid, having law enforcement all around me. It was just, I didn't know what it is not to have. So I just had to fight and fight and fight and keep pushing and keep going forward. And I just dealt with it. It's, you know, it's funny because you know, I had this condition watch where your beard, you lose it a little bit, you know, in a different spot. I forget what you call it, but I went to the doctor. He said, you know, that's normally caused by stress. Do you have a lot of stress? And I said, well, I don't know, doc. I said, I've just been living a certain way my whole life. I don't know what the definition of stress is. This is just my life without getting into all the details. So I don't know. I've just been very blessed and very fortunate that I was able to deal with
it. I hear that. What was it like what was the situation that caused the entire scam to collapse with the gasoline?
Well, my partner became an informant, and he kind of blew the whistle on the whole operation to save himself. And he did make a deal with them. Got favorable treatment. He went into program, and, you know, on a case that he could have gotten 100 years for, he ended up doing 2 years in prison.
Okay.
But that's how they found out. They didn't know what we were doing. It was very sophisticated, and we always were a step ahead of them, so they didn't understand. But that's what toppled that, and it was eventually that's where I took the plea. You know, somebody had come to me one time and said, Michael, come on, you got all the money you need. Why don't you live out? I said, you know what? You get as much time for $1 million as you do for a million, so I may as well keep it all. All right. That was my attitude back then, which is true, by the way. When I knew that he had cooperated, what happened was he testified against me also in the Giuliani case, and we destroyed him on the stand. He was not a good witness. So now he's going to testify against me in the gas case, and the government was worried because I just destroyed that major witness in a different trial. So that's why they were willing to make a deal with me for some time. And when I realized that, I said, this may be the best chance I have because I beat them 5 times. There's going to be a time when I lose. And they're going to throw the book at me. I'm going to get 50 years. You know, they were giving guys 50, 60, 70, 100 years, the amount of time. And I was the youngest guy out of everybody. I said, they're going to give me 300 years just to get even with me. So I said, I have an opportunity to, you know, damage control, limit my liability. And I told my lawyer, I'm going to take a plea on this. They'll be happy to get conviction on me. And what happens, Zuby, when I met this young girl, who's now my wife of 38 years, that life is an evil and a bad lifestyle. And I want to say that, I want to clarify that. I'm not calling the guys an evil. Not at all. I was one of them. And not all of those guys would be. Some of them you wondered, how could you act this way? But, you know, why do good people do bad things? Who knows? It's the age-old question. But the lifestyle is evil. Because I don't know any family of any member of that life that hasn't been totally devastated, including my own. And not my wife and kids, but mother, brother, sisters, father, destroyed.
Yeah.
And that goes throughout, right? So I meet this girl, I fall in love with her. I said, when
you met your wife, was that, or future wife, was that before the prison stint or?
Yeah, before. I met her in 1984,
okay.
Right? After I had just before I was on our trial with Julianne Amet. So I fall in love with her and I said, am I going to do this to her? She's 20 years old, 21 years old. Am I going to marry her, stay in this life, and end up she's going to be, you know, without me? I'm either going to get killed or I'm going to be in jail for the rest of my life. What's the sense? So I said, I got to make a change. Plus, I'm seeing the devastation of the RICO Act. Guys, you're going to trial, did 50 years, 70 years, 100 years. I said, forget it. This life is in trouble. And I see a lot of guys becoming informants. I said, this is my opportunity. I said, if I can limit the damage to me, do a couple of years in prison, pay him back some money, marry this young girl, move out to California, get away from the life, maybe I could survive. Mm-hmm. So that was the plan. And so the real reason I walked away was to preserve a life with this young girl.
Okay.
That was it.
So do you get engaged before you went into prison or?
Got married.
Oh, you got married before you went?
Yeah, we got married in July. Funny thing, I'm on trial with Giuliani for several months. We were engaged. I didn't want to marry her because I said, if I get convicted, what's the sense? Oh, they're going to give me at least 50 years.
Yeah.
So I get acquitted on a Friday. Jury comes in, not guilty. Saturday, I take her to Vegas when you get married. If it's out of wish, I don't want to lose her right away. And then we had a big wedding, a church in L.A. later on, months later. So we got married officially again in July. I made the deal, went off to prison in December. Okay. We were only married 4 months.
And how long did you spend in prison totally?
First stint was 5 years, and then I got out on parole. I was out on parole for 18 months, and then through another series, we could be here all day. Like a fool, I fell into a trap, and I violated my and they sent me back for another 3 years. And this time it was tough because I had the 3 years. Out of the 35 months and 13 days, I spent 29 months and 7 days in solitary.
Say that again. You spent how long in solitary?
29 months and 7 days.
So how come?
Feds were very upset with me when it became public that I was walking away from that life. And because I was a high-profile figure, this was written up in the media. Life magazine did a huge story, quitting the mafia. And it was all over the media that I was walking away. Well, everybody thought I was going to become a major witness. So the feds came into the prison and said, words all over the street from our informants. You're a dead man anyway. Cooperate with us. We'll put you in a program. Help us. You know, we'll help you. I didn't want to do that. I wasn't looking to hurt people. I just wanted out of the life. But, you know, the word was on the street that I was becoming a witness because the feds put it out. And so I had a lot of trouble as a result of that. My father just about disowned me. You know, for a lot. He didn't want to have backed off. He didn't know what was going to happen. And he didn't know, you know, what I was doing. And then the boss of my family is, you know, contract all my life. And, you know, so they kept me in lockdown. They said for my own protection, but they actually created this situation that I would need protection. It was tough.
Man, 2 years plus.
Yeah.
In solitary.
Yeah.
What is that like? I can't even.
Zuby, it's torturous. You know, it really is. And I can tell you this. I saw a lot of rough things go on with guys that really couldn't handle it. And I'm not knocking him at all. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it was very tough. But to a point where I even spoke in front of the Senate staff and a few senators the anniversary of 9/11 a couple of years ago. And we talked about prison reform. And I stressed the fact that for young people, I am totally against solitary. Because if you don't have a strong constitution, it's tough to get through and come out, you know, a normal person without, you know, some severe emotional issues. So and I think people that have done a lot of time in solitary can say the same thing. It was difficult.
Yeah. How did you occupy your mind then?
You know, it was during that time, I look at it as a positive because it was during that time that I strengthened my faith.
Okay.
I mean, I became a Christian as a result of my study, not only of the Bible, but of other faiths and religions that I have a lot of respect and regard for, but Christianity worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became a person of faith during that time.
Matt, I'm curious to know, how would you have described your faith prior to that conversion period? So throughout your teens, your early 20s, your mid-20s, you're getting involved in all of this stuff. You're getting involved in illegal activity. You're surrounded by a certain crowd. What was your relationship with God like at that time?
Grew up a Catholic. Catholic school from kindergarten, high school. I was an altar boy. But Catholicism was like a subject in school. It wasn't an ingrained faith thing, you know. A lot of rules and regulations, you know, go to confession, go to communion. So it becomes kind of like, okay, I don't want to say a job. And I don't want to blame Catholics, you know. I have a lot of Catholic friends. It's certainly, you know, a Christian, part of Christianity. It just didn't work for me. I didn't take it seriously. So I had the background. I knew of God. I knew of Jesus. But it was just there.
It wasn't in the heart.
No, it was not in the heart. I had no relationship or really caring for my faith. And I didn't even think of eternity or anything like that.
So that's fascinating. And so how old were you when you got the all clear, when you came out of prison? How old were you?
Came out, I was 40.
40. Okay. And what was that experience like going back into the normal world?
You know, I knew I had my work cut out for me. Because, you know, 8 years of prison was pretty devastating. I had to begin again with a new mentality in a new land. Basically, I was out in L.A. because I wasn't back in New York where I grew up and where I prospered. I had to start all over under some rough conditions because people were still kind of upset with me. So I had to navigate those waters and then get myself going. I couldn't get a job. You know, I didn't work for anybody in my life. Well, I did when I was 16 or 17, but I worked on a World Trade Center as a laborer. But so, okay, what do? You know, how do I get going? And I had the entrepreneurial spirit and didn't work out great from the beginning. You know, I had a lot of rough waters to navigate. Had to get my head straight. And it took me a while to get going.
What was the first venture you did that really got you back on your feet?
You know, I got very blessed. I got recruited out of prison when I was ready to leave by all the pro sports leagues to talk about the dangers of gambling to professional athletes and then to collegiate athletes. It's really what started me on my speaking career, I would say. At the same time I walked out of prison, the pastor that married us, my wife and I hardly knew, I didn't know him well, asked me to come and share my testimony at the church. And the pastor in the church was so good to my family while I was away. It was so accepting to my wife and my little two children. Now we had three at the time, that I couldn't refuse him. And so I started, I spoke, I think he asked me to speak like four different times in the church. You know, he gave me the topics regarding, relating to my life. And from there, word of mouth spread. I'm getting called from this church and that church and this ministry. And then, you know, working with the pro leagues. I spoke to every Major League Baseball team. Then the NBA came. Great. The first rookie presentation team I spoke at was Kobe Bryant's rookie at that. I got to know Kobe. And it just took off. Just took off. I never thought in a million years I'd be doing it. I had no plan to do it. So they were paying me to do this too. So it was helpful, you know? So I said, wow, do I have a career like this? And then I'm asked to write a book about my life. So I write a book, Quitting the Mafia. Then I write another book, you know? And things just started to work out.
Man, you must have been feeling grateful. I mean, I'm curious to know about the sort of marriage and family dynamics to which, you know, as much as you're willing to share, because it's such a, I mean, this is such an extraordinary story on multiple levels. So you said at this point you had three little children. Okay. So they were born before
they were three.
They were born after you came out, or I'm just trying.
Well, one, my wife got pregnant just before I went in.
Okay.
And so we had one there. Then I get an 8-hour furlough. She got pregnant during that.
Yes.
And then when I was in the halfway house after my first 5 years, she got pregnant again.
Okay.
So that's the three guys. But they were all related to my prison stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, it worked out.
Okay.
So I had three little ones, and it was an adjustment. You know, kids didn't really know me. They knew me as dad in prison, you know. And they always say this, Sylvia, I left, my wife was 21 when I went in. I left a young girl. I came home to a woman.
Yes.
Who I take care of kids on her own. She visited me all over the country while I was in prison. The feds were moving me to different prisons. She would get on a plane with the kids and come. And then she had to basically take care of herself, even though her family was very supportive of her. You know, her mom was great. Brothers and sisters were supportive. So she had support. And then, of course, the church. But still, she was doing this on her own. So there was an adjustment period for her and I, too. You know, we finally getting to really know each other, you know. And we had our good times. We had our difficult times. But we're committed to the marriage, you know. And she was a tremendous woman, you know, still is till this day. And, you know, I always say this. If God wasn't in the foundation of our marriage, mm-hmm. with all the challenges we had between the prison time, we had a tough time when I was 13 months on parole, the contract on my life, you know, the failures, the successes, we wouldn't have made it. But we were committed to the marriage. She was committed to the marriage. I loved her to death. And we made it.
Okay. No, because you were telling the story and I was trying to do the math in my head. I was like, you children? I was like, what? That's what he's wondering about. Yeah. I was like, yeah. I just talked about it.
I don't know if my wife likes me talking about it. You know, but we were fortunate that God said, okay, I'm going to give you a couple of kids, and he made it happen, man.
Yeah.
Those little ties were together.
Yeah. During that time period, I mean, what was the thing you honestly found most difficult? What was the hardest part of it?
The mentality change, you know, because I always say you could take the boy out of Brooklyn. You know, I always say Brooklyn out of the boy days. And remember, this was my life. It wasn't just something I acquired in 3 or 4 years. I grew up in it. I watched it. I saw it. It was my father's son. So, but now I knew I had to do things by the book and do things different, you know? And some of the things I had in my head, tactics that I had, I still wanted to employ, but I couldn't, you know? And then it's hard to explain and describe, but it was just a whole mentality change.
When you came out of prison, was your father still in?
When I first came out, he was, when I came out the first time, he was out for a little bit.
Okay.
And then he went back in. When I came out the second time, I think he was in, and then he came out. He violated 5 times. So I had to keep track.
Did you see him? Did you see him during that?
I didn't see him for 10 years. So after I walked away, and if it was out there that I walked away, because a lot of people didn't know what I was going to do. You know, the feds did me dirty, I have to say it. They put my name on the witness list of trials that were coming up in New York with my friends to pressure me. And so even though I was telling my father, I'm not coming in, everybody says that. And then they show up, you know, the discovery material. My name was on the list. So people were nervous, you know, because look, Zuby, I could have heard a lot of guys. I mean, I was at a pretty high level. And I got around. But then all these trials are going on. I don't show up. and then I get violated, throw me back in prison. Well, why would they put him back in prison if he's cooperating? That doesn't make sense. So now when I get out the second time, when my father finally does get out, he sends for me because now he knows I'm not hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. And so after about 10 years, I see him. And it was a strange meeting at first because he said to me, you know, if you were to listen to me, I walk in the door of his house at 5:30 at 6 o'clock in the morning. And he says to me, if you would have listened to me, you would have been the boss of the Colombo family. And I looked at him. I said, Dad, have you been in like the Twilight Zone, Time Warp? I said, don't you know what's going on?
Yeah.
I'm out. He said, you're really serious about this Bible stuff? Because, you know, I'd come out to that. I said, yeah, I'm serious. He said, all right, let's talk. And that kind of broke the ice.
And that meeting happened in New York?
Happened at his house in New York.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me about the last time you, when was the last time you saw him?
Last time I saw him, he passed away at the age of 103.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in 2000, during the pandemic. He was one of the first to, I believe, go on to COVID. We didn't know when COVID was, but he was, you know, within 3 days, he was gone. I saw him about a month prior to that. And I was visiting him in New York. I was living in a home because he needed care. And I was visiting him in New York, and everything was fine. My wife, we had invited him to come out and live with us. My wife was gracious enough to do that, you know, but he didn't want to leave New York and didn't want to come at that point. But yeah, things were okay. I mean, it was different because he couldn't talk to me the same way because now I'm not part of that life.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he let his hair down a little bit. Sometimes he wasn't, but that was okay with me. It was just that, you know, I just wanted him to be my father. That was that. So, but it was okay.
What was his attitude towards it all? Towards the end of his life, I mean, living past 100, I mean, was he regretful or remorseful, or did he feel it was all justified?
I'll give you an indication of something that was kind of disappointing, to say the least. When my mom passed away in 2012, my dad was in prison again. So I went to visit him. We couldn't get him out to come to the funeral, and we were sitting in the business room. And, you know, I don't know how the conversation got into that, but I said, you know what, Dad, this life destroyed the whole family. And he immediately got defensive. He said, well, it's not my fault. I said, what do you mean it's not your fault? He said, it's not my fault. He said, I was framed. If I didn't do all this prison time, none of that would happen. I said, well, you did do the prison time, Dad. He said, but I was framed. I said, but Dad, you didn't get framed because you were a doctor, a lawyer, or a priest. You're not framed if this real bad guy is there. And he didn't want to hear it. Not my fault. So he wouldn't accept responsibility, when I say publicly, to me at least, or to anybody else. I can't judge how he felt inside. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I'm sure he had to have regrets. But my dad, you know, the disappointing thing about my dad is his legacy in that life meant everything to him. He would never become a witness. He'd never become an informant because he wanted to be known as a stand-up guy. Okay, I understand that. But on the other hand, your family was destroyed. What bothered me, too, is after his third violation, I said, Dad, you can't make it in New York because he always got violated for associating with someone else. It's a violation. I said, keep going back. Get out of New York. Come out to California. Go to Florida. Get out of here. You don't want to do it. So in my mind, well, you put the life in front of the family. And I understand your mentality. But in reality, was that the right thing to do? You might have been able to preserve your family, but you didn't. And like I said, his legacy in that life meant everything to him. That was it. Even though, Zuby, this is the thing, privately, he would tell me, this life is full of all.
Yeah.
It's different terms. Plus, he knew that life was wrong. But publicly, he didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Stand-up guy.
So over the last couple of decades, you've been living a totally new life. You've been telling your story, podcasts, books, interviews, public speaking. What currently is the sort of core theme or message that you want people to learn from your story and
testimony? It's really encouraging. It's about the ability for anybody to change their life. If they were in a bad situation like I was, they were doing the wrong thing like I was, there's always time to change. And encouraging them by saying, hey, I can change. And if God can forgive somebody like me, what are you worried about? You know, you can do that. And so it's been an uplifting and encouraging message in that regard. How do I know that? From the responses that I get. It's you know, I've really learned, Zuby, it is far more rewarding to receive, to give than it is to receive. It really is. And I've learned that because I had everything in my life, you know, that I could have as far as, you know, luxuries and things like that. But when you are able to encourage someone and they look up to you for that purpose and they think, hey, you know what, if this guy did something, I can do it, it's very motivating. And so I've been doing that for the past 25 years. You know, I'm still entrepreneurial and business-wise. I'd just like to succeed in that regard. But every book I write, every talk that I give is always leading towards trying to make somebody a better person, giving them the incentive to better themselves.
And what role has you being a Christian played in that? And how has your faith developed?
It's played everything because I can look, my job as a Christian, my responsibility is really to follow my Lord's last command at Mark 16:15, which is go out and preach or share the good word with all of creation. And in doing so, I never try to turn anybody into a Christian. And I don't try to impose my faith on them, but I'm obligated to share it. So wherever I am, whether it be a secular event or a Christian event, you know, I always share.
Do you think is the hardest part of being a Christian?
You know, everybody says, this is the thing, and this is where true Christianity comes in. Everybody believes, well, God, you're a Christian, can't drink, can't smoke, can't have sex, can't look at pornography, can't do this, can't. A lot of can-dos, right? And that's true. But if you try to do that on your own, it's very difficult. The secret is, or the reality of it is, getting closer to Jesus, understanding it, because when you have that relationship with Jesus, he changes you from the inside out. And there comes a point in time where you don't want any of that, and you can resist it easy. You know, citing scripture, I mean, you know, Paul tells us, you know, put on the armor of the Holy Spirit. That's how you fight off these temptations that we have daily. You're not going to win all the time. It's not going to be 100%. You're still human, but you're going to become a lot better because it's working on you from the inside out. You develop this Jesus conscience. Mm-hmm. And so it's a roadblock. Should I really do this? I'm human. Maybe I'll do it anyway. But most of the time, you are.
Yeah.
And that's how it's worked for me.
Yeah. I hear in popular discourse right now, increasing conversations about the crisis of masculinity or the struggles of boys and young men, lack of meaning, lack of purpose, lack of initiation and sort of knowing where to fit into society in general, let alone in a relationship. What's your view or your insight on what is going on there? Firstly, what do you think of the issue, and how do you think that we come out of that in modern Western society?
Well, unfortunately, you know, there has been a feminization or a quest to feminize men. This is great. It's obvious. It's happening here in America and in other parts of the world. We know that. And I think it's terrible. The problem is that there is a feeling in certain sectors of society that if a man is a real man and acts like a man should, that it's demeaning to women. And I think that's this whole feminist movement has started. And it's not. If a man acts like a man should man and should be and emulates, in my view, the greatest man that ever walked the face of the earth, which is Jesus of Nazareth, it's actually a benefit to women. It's a benefit. But people are not seeing it. You know, I'll give you an example. My wife, she doesn't work. I mean, she does work. She does filming and all that kind of stuff. Recently, we started to do that together. But for many years, she didn't have to work outside of the house. It was my job. Okay? I wanted to provide for her. I want to protect her. I want to take care of my kids. Had she wanted to work, I would say fine. I didn't restrict her from that. But she had her job to raise the kids and to do a lot of other things. So that's not demeaning at all. When we walk down the street, I have 5 daughters, you know. I want to protect them. I don't want them to protect me. And that's my job as a man, you know. But people think, and my daughters are all very independent, extremely independent. They all work. They have great jobs. They do what they do. But they understand that they want a man to be a man, you know, and to act like he's supposed to. We each have different roles. Two genders, we have different roles as man and woman. So Andrew Tate, who happens to be a friend, right? We communicated that. Why does he have so many followers? He has young men following him in droves because they need mentors. Now, maybe at times, you know, Andrew can be a little abrasive. His messages feel
I was all in.
We understand. But it's not so much that. It's the men that are attracted to the message. They need a mentor. Okay? So we, as men, have to be mentors to these young men, because when men are men and act strong, we have a good society.
Yeah.
And when they don't, we have weakness like we have here in this country now.
I think the answer is obvious to me, but more for the audience and for particularly young men who I know will be listening to this podcast, guys in their early 20s, guys in their teens. What do you consider to be the role of a man in society? And do you think that that is, do you think that that changes as society changes, or do you think that the core tenets just remain the same?
No, I don't think it changes at all. I think a man's role in the household is to be the head of the household. Now, again, well, what does that mean? That doesn't mean you order your wife around. It doesn't mean that you're a slave driver in any way. If people take it out of context, but you have to, you know, consulting with your wife, you have to make decisions. You have to be the one that provides for the house, whether your wife works or not. It's still your job. I don't like the guy, see the guy staying home or woman go out. Somebody's not supposed to be that. Both go out. Okay, fine. You had a career, terrific. Hey, there's many professional, you know, husband and wife who go out. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And I'm not against that at all. Listen, in my view, my wife, she's on a pedestal. I think in many ways she's a better person than I am. But that doesn't take away my role to protect and defend and provide.
Yes.
That's my job. Okay, but I don't look at her this. She's a better judge of character. I tend to be, you know, a little bit less sometimes observant. She's good and she makes me aware of that. We're a good partnership,
yeah.
You know? So, and it doesn't change with the times.
Sure.
Man has to be a man. He has certain qualities that he has to live up to and adhere to. And when he does that, society's in a better place. You know, that's what.
Do you think that there's an agenda to drive a wedge between the sexes? Because it does seem that, I mean, throughout my relatively youngish lifetime, it seems like for decades, if you really look at the media and some of the communication and some of the messaging, whether it's in schools, it's in universities, it's through Hollywood, whatever it is, it does seem that there is an intentional effort to cause men and women to view each other as adversaries and competitors rather than complementary and cooperative.
There is a movement in that regard. I don't understand it. I think it started out, you know, maybe on television years ago when they had family, like, you know, married with children, and all of a sudden that, you know, the head of the household became a goofball.
Yes.
And Ed O'Neill's a friend of mine. He'll say, it's a big look. But, you know, and that continued in Modern Family and some of these other, you know, TV series where the men became goofy, yes. You know, as the head of the household. You know, I don't know why that started, Zuby. I can't really answer that. Like, who caused that to happen? You know, when I look at women that talk about, you know, men in a certain way, my first reaction is, what kind of men are you meeting? You know, why do you have to? I saw the movie Barbie. My granddaughter, 12 years old, said, and can we go see Barbie Grapper? Sure. It was a movie for my 12-year-old granddaughter. And they're dumbing down men and making men seem silly and goofy and dumb and inferior.
Bizarre. And I think on a deeper level, it's an attack on God's design.
I agree.
Once you understand Christian view of the role of, if someone's looking for the role of a man or a role of a woman, I mean, you can, Christianity, and it's right there. It's also in Islam. It's in Judaism. There's a book from several thousand years ago, which lays it all out. So I think on a deeper level, a lot of it strikes me as just I think we're seeing a lot of rebellion against God's design.
I admire Western. And listen, you know, if you go back to biblical times and you read the New Testament, you know, when women had very little regard, they weren't held. I mean, the testimony of a woman meant nothing in court, nothing whatsoever. But when Jesus rose from the dead, who would appear first as a witness to his being risen? Women. So he elevated the status of women right then and there just by appearing, because they were the ones that went out and spread the word.
Yeah.
Usually no one paid attention to a woman. So you know, in biblical times, I mean, obviously in the Old Testament, things were different. That's just the way it was. But Jesus changed it by holding women in very high esteem.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think it's a blowback against, you know, faith and against God. And it's just demeaning to both sexes, not only to men, but to both sexes.
And people aren't happy with it. That's the funny part. Even the people who promote it and talk all the talk and say all these things and push these ideologies, when you look at their lives or you fast forward and look at their lives, and it might be 5 years, it might be 10 years when they start to see the consequences. But as you said, I think we're at the early stages of some sort of awakening of, this experiment did not quite play out.
Yeah,
the way that we thought it would.
I agree. And, you know, being 72 years old now, being married to 38 years, there's nothing better than companionship. You know, you're on the same level. You need a companion. I mean, we were made, and God says it. Man shouldn't be alone. He created woman, you know? And it's the greatest feeling in the world to have somebody that is your soulmate and your companion, you know, especially in later on. And I think a lot of these women now are finding that out. I really mean, from testimonies that I've heard from a lot of women. And I look into that because I'm concerned about it. Are you? Yeah,
for sure. Michael, what is it that you are working on now, and what is it that people should be looking forward to?
Well, listen, I'm out there speaking, you know, all the time. And, you know, as long as God gives me the ability to do that, I'll continue on that. You know, it's something that I love, writing some more books. I'm in the wine business and the pizza business.
Tell me a little bit more about the wine and pizza.
You know, it's fascinating with the wine. I'll start with that because listen to this story, Zuby. About 5 years ago, a young man, 19 years old, contacts me from Northern California and says, I want to come and meet you. So I said, okay, come down. We'll have lunch together. He comes down. And we get into a conversation. He happens to be from Armenia. And he says to me, Mr. Michael, very respectful, I've been following you since I'm 10 years old. I'm saying, I'm not an athlete. I'm not a sports figure. Why would he be following me, right? So he said, well, I've learned a lot from you. So to me, that's pretty fascinating that a 10-year-old is looking at anybody that's not a sports figure or a celebrity, right, in some way. So I said, great. And we spent 3 hours together, got to know each other a little bit more, got to know his family, wonderful family, got to know his work ethic. And then his uncle owns a vineyard in Armenia, wine vineyard, for 25 years. And he comes to me and he says, we want to introduce Armenian wine into the United States, and we want you to brand. I want to use the Michael Francis brand. I look into it, taste the wine. It's great. I said, I don't want anything high priced. I want it so people can enjoy it. We do that. Wine is great. But the story, what I didn't know is that, and this has been factually, the evidence has been there to provide this, that when Noah's Ark landed and the flood subsided, it lands at the foot of Mount Ararat. And the first vineyards in the new civilization were planted there at the foot of Mount Ararat, Armenia. So it's kind of a transforming dip, you know? And he said, you're a story of transformation. That's why we thought it would be perfect to the old world wine, the first vineyards. You're, you know, the old person's gone, the new is here. And I was fascinated by it. I said, okay, let's do it. And in the last year and a half, we've had tremendous success. And, you know, we want to make it a global brand. We're moving that.
What's the name?
Francis Wine.
Okay.
Easy. And yeah, we're having, you know, some great success, to thank God. And so we're excited about it. You know, that's one aspect. And then I'm in the pizza business. And made a long story short, a fellow that I know for 30 years has been a chef. And we went into the business about 2.5 years.
Does that stay? Like you're the most Italian-American person in the world.
Pizza and wine.
Right.
Inside of that way. And that's moving in the right direction also. So we're happy about that. And then, you know, and then I do what I do. So, you know, I was saying this, you know, my wife, you know, I got to stop traveling as much. We got to, you know, and I try to take her as much now because the kids are all grown. And, but I'm busier than ever. Busier than ever. God is, you know, Zuby, I will tell you this, and for people that are listening, to be part of, to be a made man in the mafia, Cosa Nostra, is a very challenging life. And I always say this, if you die of old age and you die free, you've really accomplished something. And so I see my life as an absolute blessing because it could have turned out so much worse. And, you know, I didn't know that. I could never predict it where I really. There was a time when I thought, I don't know if I'm going to make it, because a lot of people are upset with me. And, you know, God has just had a different plan and a purpose for my life, and it's become extremely obvious and evident. So I don't claim credit for it other than trying to be obedient. Here's the things that I did right, okay? Number one, I turned to the Lord under some extreme circumstances. I was locked up, which I thought would be for the rest of my life, and I surrounded myself with the right people. Picked a great woman to be married to, tremendous influence on, and then had good people around me help me through it.
It's a blessing. Michael, I love your testimony. I love your story. I love the fact that you're out there inspiring and influencing millions of people in a positive way by sharing your story. And thank you so much for your time.
And I love what you're doing. I'm following you. And you just, you know, we need guys at your age, you know, to pick up the mantle, so to speak, and take it forward. So keep up the great work. And that's why I agreed to sit down with you again, you know, and whatever you do that I can support.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big money on new windows now at Menards. Update your home with vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows in store, or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more window deals happening this week. Now at Menards.
Save big.